Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Africa Link. This Tuesday, the 6th of June, 2017, I'm Isaac Mugabe, your host.
With me, Wanjiku Mwaura from the social media desk.
On the program today, Ethiopia has intensified the repatriation of its nationals from Saudi Arabia ahead of a 90-day ultimatum.
More than 50,000 of them have already taken travel documents to return to Ethiopia, and 74.4% of these are women and children.
Also on the program, the European Union announces a 50 million euro package to fund a new African joint force military in the Sahel region.
The idea of the regional forces to improve their coordination, because the jihadists often attack across national frontiers.
And we are also following your comments after yesterday's story, Qatar. What has happened today?
That's right, indeed, Wanjiku. But before all that, let's first listen to what's been happening around the world.
I'm Sertan Sanderson, and this is DW News. And in some breaking news, French police have shot and injured a man in Paris who tried to attack an officer using a hammer. The incident occurred outside the famous Notre Dame Cathedral. The landmark was placed under lockdown, with no one allowed in or out of the church. France is under a state of emergency following a string of terror attacks in recent years. With 2 days left to the general elections, the UK is still reeling from the latest terror incident, which saw 7 people killed in central London. The tragedy has become politically charged, with US President Donald Trump accusing London Mayor Sadiq Khan of making excuses for extremists after Khan said that there is no need for the public to feel alarmed. UK Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, meanwhile, defended the mayor, saying that it was a trivial controversy by comparison with the enormity of what had happened on Saturday night. The UN Human Rights Commissioner has given the Democratic Republic of Congo a 2-day deadline to prove that it is serious about investigating violence in the country's central Kasai provinces. Said Al-Rad Al-Hussein said that Kinshasa failed to confirm its commitment, an international probe would be launched.
The already dire situation in the Kasai provinces of the Democratic Republic of the Congo continues to deteriorate, spreading to other provinces and across the border with Angola. Unless I receive appropriate responses from the government regarding a joint investigation by the 8th of June, I will insist on the creation of an international investigative mechanism for the Kasais.
The Kasai region of the DRC has been witnessing a major spike in violence since September, claiming more than 400 lives and displacing over 1 million people. You're listening to DW News. The FBI is attending the second day of a trial in South Sudan to consult authorities in the prosecution of a case against 12 soldiers charged with a brutal attack on foreign aid workers last year. A South Sudanese aid worker was killed during the incident at the Terrain Hotel in the capital, Juba, while at least 5 women, including a U.S. citizen, as well as other foreign nationals, were raped. Rights groups, however, have questioned the fairness of the trial because of it being held in a military court which is not readily accessible to the public. South Africa's economy has unexpectedly shrunk in the first quarter of 2017, pushing the continent's powerhouse into its first recession since 2009. Unemployment has also hit a 14-year high, piling on more pressure on embattled President Jacob Zuma to get the economy back on track, or to risk losing his job. South Africa's economy suffered a major setback when the world's 2 major rating agencies, Fitch and Standard & Poor's, downgraded its sovereign debt to junk status in April. Qatar hopes to rebuild its diplomatic relations with a host of Arab states which severed ties with the Gulf nation on Monday. Various nations have offered to mediate in the crisis, led by efforts from Turkey and Kuwait. A total of 7 Muslim nations, including Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates, accuse Qatar of supporting terrorist activities, with similar accusations also mounting from the US. For more news and information, please go to dw.com. I'm Sertan Sanderson in Bonn.
Welcome once again to the program. My name is Isaac Mugabe.
With me, Wanjiku Maura.
We begin in Ethiopia, where the country has intensified its efforts to repatriate its nationals from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to avoid their forceful deportation ahead of a 90-day deadline. Saudi authorities launched what they called a Nation Without Violence campaign, which gives 90 days to all foreigners residing in the country illegally to leave. That means they have less than 30 days from now. Ethiopians, or thousands of Ethiopians, live in Saudi Arabia as domestic workers due to lack of job opportunities back home. Some have become undocumented as they run away from abuses by their employers. There have been reports of abuses of domestic workers in Saudi Arabia, leading some to committing suicide, hence drawing condemnation of the kingdom by rights groups in its handling of migrant workers. From Addis Ababa, Koleta Wanjohi sent this report.
The number of Ethiopians residing in Saudi Arabia illegally is not clear, but the Minister for Information, Negeri Lencho, says that an average of 1,000 Ethiopians are registering daily for free transportation back home at the special mobile centers set up in Saudi Arabia.
More than 50,000 of them have already taken travel documents to return to Ethiopia, and 74.4% of these are women and children. And among these, more than 20,000 Ethiopian migrants in Saudi Arabia have so far returned to Ethiopia safely.
Saudi Arabia is one of the common destinations for many Ethiopians, especially those seeking for work. They are taken by brokers at a fee and may end up being domestic workers. Ethiopian Airlines, the national carrier, has increased the number of flights on the Saudi Addis Ababa route to assist more citizens to beat the deadline.
There is a possibility for those who are competent to work in Saudi Arabia to go back, and the Ethiopian government has assumed responsibility to train and equip those who want to go back to Saudi Arabia so that they can legally apply for the existing job.
Alemayo Teshome is the director of Live Addis, an organization that assists returnee migrants. He observes that with this mass return, there is bound to be a challenge of an increase in unemployment. Hence, government should engage more private organizations like his to give special training.
There is a need to see to facilitate special privilege, because these people are sitting idly at home. They might drop out from 10th grade, 8th grade, and then couldn't really compete with the college graduates.
In 2013, Ethiopia repatriated over 100,000 of its citizens from Saudi Arabia following a violent crackdown on illegal migrants.
Koleta Wanjohi reporting from Addis Ababa. Now, the European Union has agreed to give more than 50 million euros to fund a new African joint military force in the Sahel region. The force will be made up of troops from Mauritania, Mali, Chad, Burkina Faso, and Niger, known as the Sahel G5. Its main mission will be to combat jihadist groups active in the region, as well as tackle trafficking networks and illegal migration. The Sahel is home to many Islamist groups, some aligned with Al-Qaeda. More than 3,000 French troops and 12,000 UN troops have been engaged in Mali since 2013, when Islamist and Tuareg militants led an insurgency in the north of the country. So why would the EU want to fund a new joint African force? A question I put to Paul Melly, Associate Fellow, Africa Programme at Chatham House in London.
The idea of the regional force is to improve their coordination and the way they cooperate across borders, because the jihadists, of course, are no respecters of national boundaries and often attack across national frontiers. So the regional force is really, as a first step, an effort to strengthen the way the countries of the region themselves operate in tackling jihadist terrorism. And in the long term, it's a building block for the day when eventually the United Nations force MINUSMA in Mali, and potentially also the French deployment in the Sahel, are withdrawn perhaps in several years' time. The hope is that by that stage, the Sahel countries will have a strong military capacity of their own.
The funds are also for non-terrorist activities to fight cross-border crime and illegal migration as well. What kind of cross-border crime exists, and how massive is this a problem?
The main problem is narcotics smuggling. Of course, there's a lot of traditional smuggling in the Sahara, trade has always been very informal. There's plenty of smuggling of normal everyday goods, but just without going through official procedures. And that's not really a problem. That's just part of the natural Saharan economy. But drugs trafficking is a major issue. And because of the sums of money involved, it has a very distorting effect.
I was speaking to Paul Milley from the Chatham House in London.
Lamin Fadera from the Gambia, West Africa, says EU's move in funding the new joint African force in the Sahel region is a great move.
Now, to the main story in the world that has hit headlines in the Gulf crisis. Qatar has backed plans for mediation talks with its regional rivals as a diplomatic row gathers pace. Six Arab countries, including Saudi Arabia and Egypt, sever ties with Qatar, with Saudi Arabia and Bahrain revoking the license of its airspace to Qatar Air. Qatar is being accused by its neighbors of supporting terrorism groups like the so-called Islamic State, IS, and the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. Hostility against Qatar has been building up in the region for quite some time now. Kuwait, one of the Gulf countries not involved in the dispute, has offered to mediate the talks. Abdul Halek Abdullah, a political scientist from the United Arab Emirates, UAE, told DW's Michelle Stockman why Kuwait has offered to play the mediator role. Take a listen.
Well, Kuwait has always been neutral and has been always in good relationship with nearly all of Gulf states, the six of them. So I think they always resort to Kuwait to do the mending of relationship and try to bridge the gap. But this crisis is really deep. This is very long-lasting, and I'm not sure that diplomatic efforts by Kuwait is going to make any dent into this. 2014, it goes back to 2014, when Kuwait really played mediating role. Qatar assured everybody, we are going to go clean, we're going to go according to what is called at the time the Riyadh Accord. Since then, everybody have been calling Qatar to do exactly, to deliver on the promises. Qatar failed time and again, and this time around, I'm not sure that the Kuwaitis can do anything about it.
And the steps that we have seen Qatar's neighbors take are pretty drastic, blocking off land, sea, air routes to the country. What does this blockade mean for people there and for businesses?
People, even Qataris who are citizens of Qatar who are in UAE, or Qatari citizens who are visiting UAE, have been asked to leave immediately. So this is very drastic. And back in Qatar, it's panic over there. Supermarkets are empty shelves all over the place. You know, nearly 50% of all of Qatar's need of food, products, etc., comes through Saudi Arabia and UAE.
That was Abdul Halek Abdullah, a political scientist from the United Arab Emirates. Wanjiku, there's so many comments about this story.
Absolutely. And still on the Middle East, first of all, there are countries that have reacted to the ongoing crisis. The Philippines, for example, has temporarily blocked Filipinos from traveling to Qatar for work because of the possible ripple effects, including food shortage.
Yes, indeed. More than 2 million people from the Philippines are working in the Middle East as domestic helpers, construction workers, engineers and nurses, with Qatar hosting 250,000 and Saudi Arabia hosting almost a million. But what are people saying about the developments in Qatar, to be specific, Wanjiko?
Yes, Donald J. Trump.
That's the U.S. president, yeah, right?
Exactly. Took to Twitter in his usual fashion and tweeted, "It's so good to see the Saudi Arabia visit with the king and 50 countries already paying off. They said they would take a hard line on funding extremism and all reference was pointing to Qatar." And you know, in his usual fashion, he goes on to Twitter to make a statement, and he seems to have spoken about the ongoing crisis.
And Didita says, "We have thousands of our troops and supplies stationed in Qatar at Al Udeid. Please be mindful of that."
And Osman Nuri says, "Qatar, they think you're a small country with a population of 3,000 people, but we are 80 million behind you." And he uses the hashtag Turkey with Qatar.
Turkey with Qatar. Well, Sufiai Assad says, "We Pakistanis are also with you. Hashtag Qatar. We all know these all are all lies. Time has changed, but policies of white race is same divide and rule." Anyway, keep those comments flowing. We'll read them whenever we can. And just in case you've just tuned in, you're listening to DW's Africa Link program straight from our studios live here in Bonn, Germany. My name is Isaac Mugabe.
And my name is Wanjiko Mwaura from the social media desk.
Coming up in the next 15 minutes, imagine learning how to surf before you can even swim, Wanjiko.
No, I would rather not imagine that because any imagination that has anything to do with water scares me.
And in dangerous waters. Anyway, listen to a South African champion surfer who perfected his skills before he even learned how to swim.
I really wanted to try the sport for a long time, but obviously I couldn't swim, so I had to like prolong my time of surfing.
It's amazing indeed, isn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely. Stay tuned for that. And please tell us what you think about that particular story and any other that we have run so far.
But first, let's go to Burundi, where the government says it has uncovered a document on the possible involvement of the European Union in destabilizing Burundi. The Burundian government says the documents cover events that date as far back as 2014. Well, in March 2016, the EU decided to cancel direct aid to Burundi, arguing that the authorities or the government had failed to properly address human rights abuses, a democratization process, and the rule of law. From Bujumbura, our own Apollinaire Nyora reports.
In the statement, the Burundian government said it had uncovered documents in circulation on the possible involvement of the European Union in destabilizing Burundi. Government spokesman Philippe Nzobonariba said those documents show that the EU provided funding to people or organizations that destabilized Burundi.
In those documents in circulation, it is reported that the EU provided funding to organizations and people involved in the destabilization of Burundi and currently subject to arrest warrants issued by the Burundian judiciary. Those revelations came to add to other elements that pushed the Burundian government to denounce a probable foreign hand in acts of sabotage of its program on peace and democracy promotion, particularly the process leading to the 2015 elections.
Le processus conduisant aux élections 2015.
According to Nzobonariba, those documents reveal terrible facts involving the EU delegation in Burundi in 2014, several months before the insurgency and the failed coup plot in May 2015. He added that the uncovered documents now confirm that some actors like the EU have encouraged the move of operating the change of the regime in Burundi. Here is again Philippe Nzobonariba, the Burundian government spokesman.
The Burundian government would like to express its deep concern and declares that it will analyse in-depth probable influences made by the EU against Burundi in decision-making.
Relations between Burundi and the EU deteriorated since the outbreak of the crisis caused by President Pierre Nkurunziza's third-term bid in April 2015. In November 2015, the EU decided sanctions against four senior Burundian security officials for their alleged involvement in the violent repression of the protests against Nkurunziza's third-term bid. The Burundian government had, however, denounced those sanctions, arguing that they were unfair. It had argued that those security officers had rather done their best to reduce damages during the insurgency.
Apollinaire Nyora reporting from Bujumbura.
Africa on the move.
For our Africa on the Move segment this week, we take you to South Africa, a country that is known to be a favorite destination for surfers. But surfing itself needs a professional trainer, and one must have harnessed well his swimming skills before they choose to float above the dangerous oceans. Well, for Kwezi Ntika, unable to swim, learned how to surf, and now he's the first black South African's surfing professional. He braved the ocean, sharks, and prejudice to make his dream come true. This report by Roti Eisenhardt Dominic is now presented by Jenny Nyenge.
Kwezi Kwika is one of the best longboard surfers worldwide. In fact, he can be number one if you take his story into account. Kwezi learned surfing in the rough Atlantic Ocean even before he could swim.
I really wanted to try the sport for a long time, but obviously I couldn't swim, so I had to prolong my time of surfing. It was very, very scary when I did eventually come over the fear of not knowing how to swim and stepping up to going in the water and being in the water where I can't swim. But I was so dedicated that I looked past that.
Longboard surfing is often seen as more artistic than the shortboard version. As a young boy, Kwesi used to sit on the beach and watch others. Back then, surfing was mainly seen as a white person sport, but that didn't stop him from achieving his dreams.
I sat on the beach watching them, and I was so fascinated with these nice turns they were doing, and they would come out and talk about how nice turns I had, and I felt so out. So then I told him, listen, I actually really want to try. He was like, really? And was really stoked and gave me my first board and suit and showed me the basics on the beach. And I was hooked.
He was 9 years then, and ever since, he hasn't left his surfboard. He actually surfed for 3 years before he could even swim.
I was lucky. My mom actually bought me a board, which cost her, I think, close to 800 rand. But she managed to get that for me. And I was that board was my life.
That was a lot of money in the poverty-stricken and crime-ridden Ocean View Township back then, but it was money well invested. Gang crime is rife in the township, and many of Kwesi's old friends spend their time in jail.
It was a good thing because it kept him busy all the time, away from the street and from the bad things.
Kwesi has become a popular surf trainer for the affluent people on the Cape Town's beaches and also has sponsoring contracts. But his heart is still in Ocean View, where youngsters eagerly wait for his free lessons.
Go to school, surf, because basically when you surf, you get yourself tired, you know, and just go out there and it's you in the ocean, you understand? Nothing is stopping you there. That's where you are free, you know, that's like your office. And I think that was my call. Actually, even if you're staying in the hood, doesn't mean your dreams are crushed, you know? There's still potential. Anything is possible. You just got to have a vision.
That is Kwesi's most important message to the young people. With donated boards and wetsuits, Kwesi takes the kids down the same path that he took to become one of the Africa's first world-class surfers.
A report by Dominique von Eisenhardt-Horte.
Focus Europe.
Now, almost 50,000 people escaping conflict and poverty have made it to Italy so far this year. Many of those rescued in the Mediterranean Sea and taken to Italy are supposed to be resettled in other European countries. But other countries are refusing to take them. So, in an effort to try to deport those deemed to be in Italy illegally, the Italian government is planning to open new detention centers to speed up deportation. But the plan has become a controversial issue. Megan Williams visited one on the outskirts of Rome and has this report.
If the tight security check at the gate and guard with a machine gun don't make it clear this is a prison, the women inside, shuffling listlessly in caged yards, certainly do. But officially, at least, the Ponte Galeria detention center near the Rome airport is not a prison, but a so-called center for identification and expulsion. 21-year-old Favor Osaherumwe from Nigeria is one of the inmates. She made it to Italy last summer after 3 months in the hands of traffickers in Libya.
We experienced many things in Libya. Rape, beating, stealing, many things.
Beside her on a steel bench sits her friend Joy Esse. Esse says that in a crammed compound near Tripoli, their captors would pull the women out regularly to rape them.
Yeah. Yes. If you do not allow them to rape you, they will shoot you. So you don't have choice because you don't want to die.
If that weren't enough, they were also forced to prostitute themselves to pay for food. They say they were taken to a place called the Connection House.
There are many girls, Nigerian girls, work with Arabo for the night, yes. We used to do it sometimes 2 times in a week just to get money to eat.
Il senso di questa permanenza.
Democratic Party Senator Luigi Manconi says it makes no sense for the migrant women to be here. Two-thirds have requested asylum and are waiting to see if they'll be allowed to stay in Italy. These women are victims of violence and prostitution rings, says Manconi. Not only are the camps inhumane, Manconi says they have a track record of failure, with only half of the inmates being properly identified. And insufficient agreements with the migrants' countries of origin make it difficult to send most people back. The male section of this center was shut 2 years ago when inmates sewed their mouths shut in protest, then set fire to the prison. As a result, Italy had begun to close them. But in a reversal aimed at speeding up deportations of illegal migrants, Italy has announced it will open new centers. But Manconi and others insist incarcerating migrants, especially women at risk of prostitution gangs here in Italy, makes no sense. He says either come up with policies that stop migration here or work on shutting down sexual trafficking. In the meantime, the women inside Ponte Galeria wait.
Freedom! We need documents to stay in this country, to live a very good life.
That report was compiled by Megan Williams. Now back to you, Wanjiko Maura. What's on the social media now?
Well, as you heard in the news, South Africa has fallen into recession for the first time in 8 years. And this has caused so many South Africans on social media to wonder what is going on?
To get worried, yeah.
Absolutely. Ulrich Jan van Furen says South Africa has officially slipped into its second recession. How did we get here?
Well, they've been there before. And in fact, two ratings agencies downgraded a portion of the country's sovereign debt, the so-called junk status, even some time back. We really covered that. Pisile Maseko says we need divine intervention and change in government. Ole and Company says African leaders have capacity for so many things. Taking anything from grace to grass is the cheapest of them all. Wake up, African youth.
Isaac 2060 says the well-being of South Africa simply isn't Jacob Zuma's priority. It is a bit sad.
And Mandlan Kosi says recession depends on many economic factors. I don't see how blaming one person is fair in this case. Businesses must contribute as well.
And Mashilo says, recession apologies to everyone I owe. I cannot pay you back. Blame it on the recession. Of course, taking advantage of the current economic situation there in South Africa.
Yeah, Daniel Peter says, wow, welcome on board, hashtag SA, meaning South Africa. We being the landlord in here for 2 years already, that is Nigeria, that is a little bit sarcastic. Alexander says, let's see how South Africa would handle this. Nigeria could probably learn something.
And speaking of Nigeria, Aisha Buhari, the wife of Nigeria's president, Muhammadu Buhari, just came back from a trip in London where the president, she says, is recovering from his illness.
This is Buhari's second trip, just to bring you to speed, to the UK this year, seeking treatment. He has been in London for almost 4 weeks. And what are people saying about the latest visit?
Well, Gloria says, get well, President Buhari. Osin Deji says, no one prays for anyone to be sick, but aging is a natural process. Stress is the number one killer of the aged. President Buhari needs to rest, not presidency.
Well, one thing that buffers Nigerians is the silence, of course. And one comment to that effect is from Afam Odiozo, who says, the conspiracy of silence surrounding Buhari's health is an excellent barometer to gauge the level of development in Nigeria. I like the way they play with their words, yeah.
Absolutely. They find a way to find humor in whatever situation. Jim Jones says, it's wonderful that he is feeling great. I hope he is well and healthy enough to govern and will not be traveling back again.
Anyway, keep them flowing, Shan. Read them whenever we can. Wanjiku, just, you know, for sports lovers, especially tennis lovers, the two men's quarterfinal matches due to be played at the French Open, that was today, have been postponed until Wednesday after rain disputed the play at Roland Garros. That's according to organizers. That's breaking news. And what do you have for football?
For football, condolences are still streaming in after the death of Cheikh Tiote. yesterday, and it's quite unfortunate. Magdala says, thank you for what you've offered. The football world will never forget your equaliser and 8-3 versus Arsenal. Rest in peace.
And there we come to the end of this edition. On behalf of the production crew with me in the studios, I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And Wanjiku Mwaura.
Bye for now.